Committee to order. Representative Butler asked me to begin. He'll be here shortly. We're going to open the hearing on Senate Bill 5530, which is the Oregon Liquor Control Commission's budget. We're starting off today, and Susie Jordan is with us from LFO to give us a general overview.
Mr. Chair and Senator Winters. First, I'm just going to kind of give you an overview of the calendar for this week. Today we're doing the overviews, and if we have time, we'll do an overview for the merchandising program area. Tuesday we'll continue with the regulatory program support services, and then any responses that the agency has to questions that weren't answered today. And Wednesday we'll do agents' compensation and capital improvements. There is one person that Representative Butler has agreed to testify on Wednesday. That's Mayor Drake from the City of Beaverton, and then Thursday will be a public testimony day. So I'm going to refer you now to the handout that I have at your places on the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Yes, you've got it. The governor's budget for 2003-05 is a total of $83,468,045 total funds, and there are 201.27 FTE proposed in this budget. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission's mission and purpose has two functions. One is to regulate the sale and the distribution, and to sell alcoholic beverages. On page 2, the pie chart at the top of the page is a breakdown of the revenue distribution, and the blue areas are distributions to the cities and counties and other statutory requirements. The red is the distribution to the general fund. They are projecting $117 million to be distributed to the general fund. And the green area is the expenses that comes off the top, and that is agency administration of 12.5% and the agent's compensation at 16% of the total revenues. The bar chart at the bottom of page 2 shows that liquor sales account for the majority of the revenue in the Liquor Control Commission and has increased 36% since 1995. On page 3, the bar chart at the top of the page shows the expenditure side of the budget, that the growth is primarily on the agent's compensation side. The agency administration has been relatively slow growth. And the pie chart at the bottom of the page shows the breakdown of the budget between agencies, administration, regulation, and merchandising, and then agents' compensation at 57% of the budget, 10% merchandising, 16% regulatory, and 17% is administration and support. And finally, on page 4 are some of the budget and policy issues that you will be looking at in the agency's budget. Liquor sales, special session reductions, the impact on their regulatory functions, college drinking, there's a package in there to provide some overtime to the universities to assist them in inspections, agents' compensation, which is an issue every session, in that we, the agency tries to provide some packages to provide benefits or additional compensation, and because of the budgetary restraints, they haven't been able to get that through the governor's budget. Merchandising, modernization of their information systems, and then capital improvements. Next is a handout of the policy issues that were dealt with during the interim by the Emergency Board, just for your reference. In April, they provided a report relating to the continuing payment of fees on credit cards used to purchase liquor products. In the last legislative session, in order to save money in their budget, one of the things that was removed was the payment of credit card fees for agents. And during the interim, the agency came back and said that wasn't really practical. It did more harm than the benefit, and they found ways that they could mitigate that by continuing to pay those credit card fees for agents. And then following underneath there are the special session actions on effect on this budget, and you can see that at close of session, the other fund's limited budget, this, the first column there was $77.1 million. In second special session, we reduced their budget $640,399. In third special session was an increase for salary employee compensation adjustments. And then in fifth special session, $1.2 million was removed from their budget as part of their proportionate share of the reductions. And the effect of that was to eliminate 11 positions in the regulatory program. And then in March, just our most recent action was to increase their budget by $377,488 to provide additional expenditure limitation for agents' compensation and allowing for a reduction in salary savings for vacancies. So their currently approved budget is $78.9 million. Third handout is a just a budget note relating to their retail system modernization, and the report that they made to the Joint Legislative Management Information Management Technology Committee is also attached behind that. And the next attachment is my analysis of the budget. And then the last attachment are the packages that are included in the agents in the Liquor Control Commission's budget, and then the remaining reduction options should we need to make further reductions in their budget. And if the committee has any questions?
I just have one question, Mr. Chair.
Senator?
And just to help me, give me the purpose or the delineation between agency administration and the distribution to human services and wine advisory board.
This is on the pie chart on page 2. The difference between these is that the distribution to human services and wine advisory board is a statutory requirement to distribute a certain amount of money from the wine tax to the human services mental it's alcohol treatment
That's
program.
The old alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the wine advisory board gets a portion of that money for their to operate their programs. And those are statutorily driven.
Combined amount of 4.2%?
Yes. Then the agency administration, those are their actual expenses for running the agency.
Do you have a breakdown between the human services and the wine advisory?
I can get that for you. It's in there.
Really, that would be, that would appear to be two totally and entirely separate issues. One going towards
human services. There's the transfer to human services is $12.7 million, and the wine advisory board is $307,000, something like that. Oh, the $366,000 that's in here. Yeah.
That makes up the $13 million.
Yes.
So wine advisory is a very, very small portion of that.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Senator, please follow up.
Follow up. Is the advisory board just for their compensation and travel and meetings?
I'm not sure what they are compensated for. Do you have an answer for that?
It's wine promotion, isn't it?
Or is it promotion?
Research and promotion.
Oh, it is research
and promotion.
Okay, further questions of Ms. Jordan? Okay. Next, according to my schedule here, is Phil Lang and Karen Gregory. But I understand Mr. Lang will go tomorrow, I believe, or Whenever he'd like to.
Probably Wednesday.
Wednesday, all right. Ms. Gregory?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Karen Gregory. I'm the interim director of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and I see your bank, so I'm just going to go ahead and put my money into it before we even get started.
American Cancer Society thanks you very much. Just tell us how many acronyms and what they are that you're buying. And Representative Johnson keeps track of those.
Mr. Chairman, before I get started, if I may, I would like to introduce some members in the audience. Our chairman, Phil Lang, is here today. He's the chairman of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. He's been our chairman for 5 years, and he is from Congressional District Number 1. And we have a number of our staff here who are going to be either making presentations to you or will be helping to answer questions that you may have. Merle Lindsay is our Director of Administrative Services and also our Acting Deputy Director. John Steubenball is our Communications Director. Steve Farrow is our Director of Purchasing and Distribution. Linda Ignowski is our Program Director for Regulatory. Michael O'Connor is our Acting Fiscal Services Director. Alex Lennox is our Research Analyst. And Harry Richards is our Budget Guru. So with that, this morning I would like to talk with you about our strategic planning efforts and what we've accomplished. But before we get into that, I would like to build a foundation for you as to why there's a Liquor Commission, how we came into being, what the key trends are that we look at to run our business, how we're structured, and what it is that we do. From that, we'll move into our planning strategies and what we accomplish, and then others will move you into depth into our programs, including our relationship with liquor agents. The OLCC was created in 1933 after the repeal of national prohibition. The Knox Act established the Oregon Liquor Control Commission and gave it the authority to regulate those who manufacture, sell, or serve alcohol products. It also gave the commission the exclusive right to sell the distilled spirits, packaged distilled spirits. And then in 1952, Oregonians changed the Constitution to allow distilled spirits to be sold by the drink. Oregon is one of 18 control jurisdictions throughout the country. There are 17 other states who are considered control states, and there is one county. In a control state, the state actually takes ownership of the alcoholic beverage at some point in the process, and they become the exclusive seller in a particular sector of the business. In a number of control states, you have totally state-run stores. There are state employees in those stores, and the state actually maintains the leases on the stores. And they may also be in the wholesale business. On the other spectrum, you may have simply a state who is in the wholesale business and not in the retail business at all. Oregon is right in the middle of that. We have semi-privatized already. We have our liquor agents who are small business people who contract with the state of Oregon to sell distilled spirits in our stores, and we run the wholesale business. So you might ask, why do we have a control system? Well, the Knox Act wanted to take the business out of the liquor business and deal with it largely as a matter of public safety. It also said that the elements of the private profit should be eliminated entirely from the retailing of liquors of the higher alcohol content. Because of that, OLCC remains an effective vehicle to protect public safety through alcohol control today. Our mission describes the fundamental purpose of the agency as set forth by statute. It's the ultimate goal of the OLCC's collective actions, and it highlights the basic value of the agency to its constituencies. The mission of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission is to regulate effectively the sale, distribution, and responsible use of alcoholic beverages in order to protect Oregon's public health, safety, and community livability. We're committed to providing and regulating alcohol while protecting Oregon's quality of life. We also have goals, and these goals are the highest priority purposes of the agency, and along with the mission statement, they allow us to describe our desired strategic positions. we accomplish our mission by working to, first of all, educating the industries and individuals who manufacture and sell alcoholic beverages and the public who may want to consume them. We aim to serve as a leader in making information and training about alcohol available to all sectors of society, really targeting Oregon's youth. Another of our goals is working in partnership with local governments, other agencies, private industry, and members of the public to achieve a high quality in life in Oregon, free of the dangers of alcohol abuse. We believe that working with others in close partnership enhances both our endeavors and theirs. Our decisions affect people's lives, and we understand that. And we keep in mind that we make the best decisions by working closely with others to achieve balanced and fair solutions. On a daily basis, we work in partnership with our licensees to assure their compliance with liquor laws and help them contribute to protecting their community's livability. Another goal is to make alcohol available to legal users through quality customer service. We assure that alcohol is reasonably available to adults who choose to drink. We accomplish this by contracting and licensing with responsible business people who will provide convenient, well-run establishments, comply with liquor laws, and foster responsible liquor sales. We also provide optimal revenue in support of state and local governments. We balance acquiring liquor revenue on the one hand with the need to protect communities by limiting alcohol availability and misuse. We seek to ensure that efficient internal controls provide highly productive systems to serve the public. This helps us to optimize our commission budget and return an appropriate profit to state and local governments. And our final goal is to promote commission employee growth through creating and nourishing a rich environment. We invest in gaining training, skill development, and other tools that we need to perform well in a rapidly changing world. And we strive to create a work environment that inspires us to contribute our best, both at work and in strengthening our own communities. In order to meet our mission and goals, we need to understand some key trends in our operating environments. Some of the most important trends include adult per capita consumption of distilled spirits. On this chart, you see that the per capita consumption of distilled spirits was in long-term decline until 1995-96. Since then, consumption rates have pretty much stabilized, and there's even a slight increase, as you'll notice, beginning in 1999.
That's national consumption, is that correct, Karen?
Actually, this is Oregon, Mr.
That's
Chair.
That's Oregon.
Consumption of beer and wine has also declined, but now appears to be more stable than in the 1980s and 90s.
Senator Winters?
How do we compare with other states our size, population size, and who do not have a controlling situation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winters, we are pretty much in the middle to the lower end on alcohol consumption as far as size. We have not looked at at other states in our same size.
I think it would be helpful as we go when we have a few more days that we do, because you've got two different kinds of models.
And I think what you're getting at then, Senator, is to take a look at the controlled states. What of the other 17 control states? Do we fall in the middle of the 17 control states as well?
Mr. Chairman, I hear Mr. Lonick saying yes.
Okay. And then in addition to the control states, the non-control.
Okay. We will bring that back to you.
Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Chair Old Butler.
There you go. Hey. I mean, when you got Becky, what do you
expect? Perhaps you could help me understand with the declining per capita consumption, and I see that it rises slightly in the last year. The agents have sold a great deal more product. Does that account for just that little tiny rise? I mean, there's been the discussion about the legislature using part of the unexpected increase in agent sales to help balance the O3 budget. Reconcile that for me against the per capita consumption decline.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, certainly agents have been selling more cases, but the number of cases, the amount of product that they've been selling, has actually not increased a tremendous amount. This small blip that you see is those few numbers of cases. Where we have actually gotten our increase in sales is because the distilled spirits industry has really broadened the array of products that are available, and they've really extended the higher-end products. So in the last number of years, things like single malt scotches, barrel bourbons, those kinds of things, the really higher end, have really been the items that have increased our sales.
So it's not consumption, but it's higher ticket items that have been offered in the stores.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, it's a combination, but the sales predominantly are because of those higher end products. And as I said, we have had some case increase in sales.
Thank you.
The next trend that we take a look at is our alcohol consumption in the last 30 days of our 6th, 8th, and 10th graders. While this consumption is still below its 1988 peak, juvenile consumption started to grow in 1992 and reached a plateau in the mid-90s. Alcohol remains the drug of choice for Oregon's youth. The next area is the growth of our licensed businesses.
Senator Winters,
it would be helpful for me. We talk about Oregon, but I would like to, with all of these graphs, have some comparison of other states, those that are within the control and the non-control. It gives you a better picture, to me, of what's taking place.
And Karen, because Oregon is a control state, and we are talking about adolescent alcohol abuse, and it is abuse. I mean, any alcohol is abuse at that particular point. Do we have a breakdown as between distilled spirits and beer and wine?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe we do, but beer is certainly the choice of most younger consumers.
So we do need a breakdown. We need to have you replicate this relative to where Oregon is nationwide, and the same series of statistics that you're providing us today, as well as I would like to know if we do have, and I know there are some cases of adolescent alcohol abuse with the distilled spirits, but I would like to know, have some idea what portion, if there are some in there that do deal with adolescent use of distilled spirits. Senator, was that responsive to your question?
Yes.
We'll need to get those nationwide graph figures, too. Please.
We'll be happy to bring that back. The next graph is the growth of our licensed businesses. Since 1991, travel spending in Oregon at eating and drinking establishments has increased substantially. This, of course, creates a much greater demand for restaurants and entertainment facilities, and most of those facilities apply for liquor licenses. The increase here is 27% between 1991 and 2003.
Is there any limitation, Karen?
Pardon me, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any limitation that's limited only by...
Mr. Chairman, there is no limitation on the increase in licenses at this point.
Thank you.
We also have a diversified economy. Many years ago, we certainly were dependent on timber and other natural resources. Today, we have technology and service industries that have taken a much greater role in our economy. And while they're generally cyclical businesses, they do offer greater potential for economic and income growth. Another key trend we watch is our growing population. Our population has increased 24% since 1990, and much of that growth has been in migration.
So 24% growth in the state in our population, but 27% increase in distribution outlets.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
So, and that would be interesting to overlay that in relationship to the overall consumption of alcohol over that same 10-year period in Oregon.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And finally, we have the growing demand on regulatory services. The total number of licensed businesses has increased, as we said, by over 27%. And our regulatory staff has actually declined in the 1990s, and we will continue to decline in regulatory staff for this biennium 03-05. We do link to the Oregon benchmarks.
I'm sorry, Representative Johnson?
I heard you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You just said that your regulatory staff will decline.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, yes.
How does that decline in regulatory staff equate to any other staff, for example, staff that are available to help establishments become licensed? I'm trying to make a differentiation between sort of the service side of your organization that's there to help liquor agents, help premises, and the enforcement side, where I think you just said there's going to be a decline. How does that relate to the folks that are not in the enforcement side of your shop?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, we have 11 people, 11 full-time equivalents in our regulatory program who will be no longer as of 03-05 budget. Five of those in the licensing area, one of them is a manager, four of them are license investigators. Those folks are the people who allow new businesses to come into Oregon and get into business.
So those are the licensing folks.
That's correct.
Okay. So out of the 11, you're considering them all regulatory, and perhaps I didn't understand the nomenclature, but out of these 11 regulatory, you have five positions that you're losing that are doing licensing.
Directly, yeah.
And you have four that you're losing that are doing investigatory enforcement.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, though, that's not quite right. We have four licensed investigators who are on that list, along with one manager. We have no one from the compliance side, the enforcement side, on the list of cuts. We have other people in our licensing area who are really support people in the licensing area. We also have two positions in our server education area, which is considered regulatory, and we also have one position in our wholesaling manufacturers area, which is a regulatory position.
I'm sorry if I'm making this more difficult by virtue of my ineffective grasp on your nomenclature, but what I'm trying to make the distinction is that I would see the folks that are doing the enforcement, by your description, uncut, and the people that are trying to help premises become licensed cut rather substantially. And I'm trying to understand, at a time when we're all striving to find economic development tools, one could easily deduce from what you're saying that were I to want to go out and open a licensed premises tomorrow, that I would find there to be fewer people in your shop there to assist me and do the work to get me licensed and up and running, but no cut in the enforcement side at all.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that is correct, and the reason for that is that we feel that public safety is our number one priority, and in our enforcement side, we have only 35 positions to cover the entire state. So when we balance, do we cut enforcement or do we cut licensing? We chose to cut licensing.
One more question.
Follow up, Representative Johnson.
Do you have any kind of internal analysis that shows, as a result of losing those licensing positions, how much delay will inure to premises that are interested in coming into lawful compliance but now don't have the assistance of people in your on your staff to help them go through the regulatory hurdles? I'm trying to get some idea if I want to go out and open a restaurant tomorrow and I need a liquor license, how long is it going to take me as a result of your decision to leave enforcement people and cut licensing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that's a very good question. Our goal is to have licenses, if they have no problem, if they are not someone who has a history, let's say, of felonies and so on. If it's just a clean license application, our goal is to have that license to the licensee and to get them in business within 30 days.
Please follow up.
Currently, We're probably running 45 to 60 days, and with the cut in that licensing group, it will be 90 to 120 days.
One last question, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have an industry advisory council who helps you work through some of these decisions? Because it certainly strikes me that if 30 days is your performance standard, and you're now going out 120 days, that's a fourfold increase off of what should be your goal. That seems excessive to me. Perhaps I'm just looking at this strangely, but in an environment where the governor has made it manifestly clear in his inaugural address and in subsequent remarks that streamlining of permits and trying to help get business up and going is one of his chief priorities, a fourfold increase over your norm performance seems high.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, and we don't disagree with you. As I said, right now we are running 45 to 60 days. We're taking a third of that entire licensing staff in these cuts. So when you take a third of a whole organization that does nothing but licensing, what you're left with is expanding that period of time. What happened in our cuts were public safety was not cut, nor was any of our revenue generation. That leaves a small area within the agency to attain the cuts that we took. And our cuts are about $2.5 million out of a pretty small agency. So
let's get into that when we go into the licensure portion of your...
I'd like to reserve the opportunity
regulatory, because that does seem to be... Senator Winters?
Just because I want to follow on where Representative Johnson was. And you mentioned that you took two positions out of the server education program. Two questions. One, is it because some server ed is being handled by the Oregon Restaurant Association? And if that had any impact in that decision, or were your servers ed the one that actually validated and approved based on what's going on out in the field?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, our server education program oversees the entire server education project, and the Restaurant Association is a provider, just like all of our other providers, and they provide education. So it had nothing to do really with the Restaurant Association being in the business. Again, we just had to make some very tough decisions.
Question then, how much time, what's the time delay in actually approving those server ed request?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, if there is a new provider who wants to come in with a new training program...
I'm not talking about new provider. Let's just take the current state of the art of where we are currently, and you have providers who are training individuals. You have the Oregon Restaurant Association, who are also now providing training. What is the time period when they send the information to you? Is there a delay? And if there is, what is the delay?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, I believe you're speaking of the service permits themselves. There is no delay.
No delay.
We have not cut that area.
So when you cut the two server ed positions, you haven't experienced any delay?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, first of all, those two positions have not been cut. They'll be cut as of July. But we will not have delay. What we will have is the possibility of having educators out there who are not well trained. That's what our people do. First of all, we look at all the curriculum, make sure it's accurate, and we also go in and take a look at all of the trainers and make sure that they're doing a good job.
Is that under administrative support?
It's under regulatory.
Regulatory.
Yes. And actually, these positions are provided for with a $13 server education fee that comes in with the permit. So it is a fully funded area within the budget.
Okay. Was that responsive, Senator?
I guess my question is, if it's fully funded and it's funded by the activity, then my question is, and that activity is for that purpose, then why were those positions singled out for cut?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, again, we just had to make tough decisions. And if these positions are not put back, more than likely what we'll end up doing is cutting the dollar amount that the permittees pay because $13 funds these positions, we could probably take it down to $6 or $7. I don't know what the number would be.
It would be counterproductive at that
point,
it would
be.
Okay. Please proceed, Karen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next topic is the links to the benchmarks. This is on page 6 of your overview. The primary benchmark that directly addresses outcomes of OLCC's activities is number 49, which is the number of 8th graders who have consumed alcohol in the last 30 days as represented by the Department of Human Services survey. As we've mentioned before, preventing underage drinking is a top priority for the Liquor Commission. And we've also developed many other performance measurements as part of our strategic planning process, and we use those measurements to track our progress. I'll talk to you a little bit more about this progress report, but when you get to it, there actually are two pages of performance measurements within it.
In terms of one of those performance criteria, and I know you're talking primarily about licensees and not agents in this, achieving a 67% compliance rate for sale to minors and then making a goal of a 70% compliance rate doesn't seem like a very high standard for sales to minors. Are there some comparisons to other states that have similar systems in this regard also? I mean, it means basically one out of three minors can purchase alcohol at licensees' establishments.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Devlin, actually what we've discovered is as we go out among the states where we haven't done minor decoys in the past, the sale rate is 70%. So as you bring the more rural areas that we are just hitting, you bring them into compliance, and that balances with our being able to get closer to, we do quite a few decoy operations in the metropolitan areas as with police departments. So when you meld those figures together, that's where you come up with the 70% compliance rate. And actually, as a national average, that's pretty close to what most of the states are doing. We would like that to be zero, and that's really where we're getting to. That's where we want to be, but the reality is that it's going to be a number of years before we get chunked down to a low level.
Mr. Chairman, please follow up, Senator.
In regard to that, it's not the same thing as decoys, but I noticed one of your other criteria in terms of contacts with your regulatory officers and licensees. You had about 31 or 32 contacts per month on average, and you're setting a goal of 25 contacts per month. Why setting a lower goal than what you've been able to achieve?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, that's a very good question. What we did was we made visiting all of those licensees a priority, and we had them all visited within a two-year period. What we discovered was that having our license, our compliance folks doing that, that became their priority as opposed to actually working on problem premises and giving more time and energy to the licensees who needed it. So what we did was we got everybody taken care of in a two-year period, and then we decided that it would be better to move off of that a little bit and have everyone visited within a four-year period. Our hope is that we'll do better than that goal, but that's why we chose to change it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your answer.
Thank you. On page 7 of your overview, there is a functional organizational chart. And what I'd like to do is move into the structure of the Liquor Control Commission and talk to you about our 5-member board of commissioners. They're charged with administering the Liquor Control Act. And these are citizen commissioners. They're appointed by the governor, and they're confirmed by the state senate for 4-year terms. Each represents a congressional district. And they act as our board of directors, making important and controversial decisions for the commission. They set all of the policy direction for our staff. They grant and deny certain licenses. They resolve contested cases, and they appoint and terminate liquor store agents. In addition to that, they hire or appoint an administrator to serve as director of the agency and manage the agency's daily operations. Today, we have a staff of 217 FTE, or full-time equivalents, They currently administer the Liquor Control Act on behalf of our citizen commissioners, and the governor's balanced budget takes that FTE ratio down to 201 for the 03-05 biennium. Our staff are divided into three functional areas to carry out our mission and goals. That's regulatory, merchandising, and support services. And these three areas constitute our administrative budget limitation. We also have our agent's compensation budget limitation, and this limitation funds all of our contracted liquor agents to operate the liquor stores that sell the distilled spirits by the bottle throughout the state. Now I'd like to just give you a very brief overview of all of our programs, starting with the regulatory program. The major function of the regulatory program is to issue liquor licenses to anyone who manufactures, distributes, or sells alcohol by the drink or by the bottle. They also issue service permits to anyone who serves a drink by the glass in our restaurants or taverns. They ensure compliance with our liquor laws, and they administer the server education program. We have about 10,000 licensees, and we have almost 100,000 service permittees. Some of our customers are local governments, police departments, neighborhood groups, and the general public, as well as other interested parties and moderation groups. As I've mentioned, our staffing and regulatory has not kept up with the growth, particularly since cutbacks in the 1990s. As a result, we continue to prioritize our compliance work, and we focus on preventing the most serious problems, such as the overconsumption of alcohol by minors, actually any consumption by minors, sales to visibly intoxicated people, and premises that pose serious public health, safety, or neighborhood livability issues. We have 11 field offices, plus our Milwaukee main office, and the number of full-time equivalents in the regulatory program are 91 in the governor's budget. The merchandising program, in brief, that program operates the bottled distilled spirits business on behalf of the citizens of Oregon. Our sales for fiscal 2002 were $258 million, and of that, $104 million returned to the general fund cities and counties. We have three divisions. Our purchasing area orders all of the product from distilleries worldwide. They arrange delivery to the warehouse, and they also manage the product. The product gets into our warehouse. Our distribution manages the receiving, storing, and shipping of those products. They take the product in from the distilleries, store it, and then ship it out to our stores. Distribution ships about 3.7 million cases a year, and we also secure an average of $17 million in monthly retail inventory in our warehouse. I'd like to let you know, though, that that inventory in our warehouse is not owned by the state of Oregon. It's a bailment warehouse, and all of the inventory in that warehouse is owned by the distillers. The state of Oregon does not take title to that product until it leaves the warehouse on its way to the liquor stores. And the third area in the merchandising program is store operations. These are the folks that work with the 238 liquor agents to sell distilled spirits. The liquor agents sell over 19 million bottles annually. They manage their inventories in the stores and promote effective merchandising. Store operations helps them to develop customer service standards, and they work with the agents to improve store appearance. They also educate the agents on laws, policies, and procedures and rules. Our priorities in the merchandising program are modernizing and gaining efficiencies through technology and applying good business principles. Another priority is improving the number of liquor stores as well as the location and appearance of our liquor stores. The total staff in the merchandising area is 48.17 FTE.
Representative Johnson, recognized.
Given the severity of the current budget situation statewide, and given the fact that the legislature has decided to use some of the additional sales of the agents, you mentioned a partnership earlier, and I want you to elaborate a little bit on that. How have you adjusted your demands on the agents given the difficulty that we're having in the budget right now? Are you asking them to continue to incur costs, say, in IT? Or, whoops, sorry, that's a quarter. Are you asking them to continue to incur costs at a time when we're decreasing the compensation available to them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, there is a memo that is out amongst agents, and certainly it's a plan that I put forward to our commissioners a month ago, I believe, about incurring some information systems costs if we don't get the funding for it through the legislative process. The commissioners, though, will make the final determination on that. And actually, we have a number of agents who are participating in getting more electronically tied to us anyway. What we may end up doing, and the chairman has mentioned that if we don't have more staff, for instance, we may stop our opening of new stores at such a fast rate as we have been opening. We certainly have not said to agents that we don't want them to manage their inventory or that we don't want them to continue making their stores attractive. So those elements are still pretty strong with the agents.
Karen, I think what Representative Johnson was asking is how much of that. I appreciate the fact that you're not telling your agents you don't want their stores to look nice and for them to operate efficiently. I think the question was how much of that are you trying to shift to the agents? Are the agents being asked to pick up a greater portion of the freight relative to how much they have to do themselves versus what the commission will do?
Well, Mr. Chair, at this point, the commission hasn't made any decision to transfer any of that freight to the agents. The compensation formula has been shifted somewhat, and the memo went out to agents, and I believe they got it probably Thursday or Friday. We've had to chunk that down 0.25% in order to make sure that agents could get paid between now and the end of the biennium because sales are going up, but the comp was only funded at half of the request. Other than that, the commission has not made any other shifts.
Okay. Representative Johnson?
One last follow-up. When you're making decisions like that, that are, as the chair has characterized it, shifting the freight to the agents, at what point do the agents get any input into your decision-making process?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, the commission is very open to having input from all areas. And
I don't doubt that, but is there a formal process?
Typically what we do is we'll send a memo out, we'll ask agents for their written input. Oftentimes we will have a commission meeting where they can come and have a talk with the commissioners face-to-face. We will be doing that, as a matter of fact, at our April commission meeting on this information technology memo that I know everybody is interested in. So, yes, there is a formal manner in which to take care of that. We also have an agents advisory council, and they meet generally 3 times a year, and we work with the agents on topics at that venue as well.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I'll
move. Here,
I'm sorry, Senator Winters. I beg your pardon.
Could you provide us with the written process and procedure? I do better with something in front of me than I do with just the communication of what that procedure is, so that if you have one of the agents who wanted to access, just how that really flows.
Okay.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. We'll move now to the support services program, and I'll just briefly talk about that because almost every agency has a support services program. This deals with our policy setting, our human resources, our information technology, and so on. But I'll just focus on a couple of the things that are different with us. We have a fiscal services department that has to account for the revenue from all 238 liquor stores, as well as the revenue from privilege tax on beer and wine and our licensing fees. And also a little difference in our fiscal department is that we have a store auditing function of the 238 liquor stores. So we actually have auditors who go out and count the product and make sure that the balances in money and inventory in the stores are accurate. I'd like to move now into our strategic planning process.
Skipped over rulemaking. Mr. Chair, and it was in the paper this morning, so I might as well bring it up now. I was going to save it for later, and that's the latest rule that has to do with entertainers. And I understand the desire to make sure that minors aren't accessing alcohol and particularly spirits and what have you. This is one, when she was a minor, who had the opportunity as a young entertainer to be able to, with her parents there, to entertain. And then I have a son who is an entertainer, and I'm concerned that, one, that we also protect them from the alcohol, but also that we do not create a situation where they cannot apply their skills. And so I just would like to hear more of the reasoning behind the recent story in the paper this morning where young entertainers can no longer entertain. And I just need to help clarify that for me, because on the one hand, as a society, we have busily over time have kept young people from having the same kinds of experience that we've had and have enjoyed as we aged, and still they did not grow up to be alcoholics, myself included. So I just have to, you know, wonder what was the genesis behind that decision. And let's see. So I would help me with that, because it was troubling for me this morning.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, I have not seen the article, but there certainly has been a lot of interest in the minor entertainer rule, as we call it. We discovered that there actually were lots of minor entertainers in what we call number one posted premises. Number one posted premises are premises where drinking is the primary activity at the premise, at the tavern. I mean, predominantly your taverns are number one posted. The minor entertainer rule simply says that minor entertainers cannot entertain in premises that have a number one posting, where it's predominantly a drinking environment. Now, minors can still entertain in venues where that is not the case, but we have made a rule for all entertainers, for all plumbers, for anyone who is under 21, not to be able to participate in a location when it's open for anything until they're 21 years old.
Would you give me some comparisons, because I'm good at comparisons. Would you give me some comparisons with states who have and have not, and tell me whether or not there's been any adverse impact? And also, would you check those states where maybe parents are required to be with, in my case, my mother and dad were required to be there with me, you know, where you have parental consent and they're actually on the premises.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So delivery of product, other maintenance within the structure itself, basically minors would be prohibited from providing any other service while the establishment was open if it's a primary tavern.
That's correct.
Number one facility. I assume then by that, Karen, that there's other facilities that are less than the number one, number two or number three, where there might be an eating establishment, an entertaining establishment where drinking is incidental.
That's correct.
And in those, then the minor entertainer rules could be such that minors could entertain and plumbers could plumb.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right.
And service can serve.
Right, and servers can serve, I guess that's right.
Because we do allow, Mr. Chair.
18-year-olds to
well, we do allow the youth to serve with the permit in restaurants. So, you know, I just need a delineation of the whys and the comparison.
Okay, I'd like to move now on to our planning initiatives. We created our first strategic plan in 1997, and these are in your books, by the way. We updated it in March of 2002, and when we started our strategic planning process, we discovered that the most serious problems were underage drinking and overservice. One in four eighth graders reported drinking alcohol in the last 30 days. And people who start drinking before the age of 15 show four times as many drinking problems at later in life as compared to those who wait until they're 21. We also developed the business plan for the merchandising program in 1999, and these plans have really guided the Liquor Commission through gaining efficiencies and modernizing our business since 1997. They have given us our plans for the future. As I mentioned to you earlier, we monitor our progress through our progress report, which is an annual document that comes out and talks not only about what it is that we do, but also holds us to our performance measurements, of which we have 17 in the back part of the report.
Karen, how old was that graph that John just took down from the overhead? Is that a current graph that shows addiction at age of first consumption?
Mr. Chairman, it is current. As to how current, this is 22803. It's from a one-time study that took place in the late 90s.
Late 90s. I guess the concern that I would have is I would like to see if we could get some update on that. We're now 2003, and with the new designer drugs and other emphasis on specialty alcohols and so forth, I'd like to know that we're still headed in the right direction downward on some of that graph. And I am concerned as I look at the last 30 days consumption in 2002, that somewhere we've lost the momentum with our 11th graders, that they're now reporting a higher level than they were back in 1990, and it's on the upswing, and it's seriously on the upswing at 44.6, according to page 13, 44.6% in 2002, reporting consumption of alcohol in the past month. And that's before the budget cuts. So I think I'd like to come back and dwell on that a little bit. I'd go ahead and invite you to continue, Karen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Today, our regulatory strategies really focus on three main areas. The first one is the enforcement of underage drinking laws. We do that through our minor decoy program, education, and other methods. We also balance education and enforcement activities. We develop partnerships with other agencies and stakeholders, such as law enforcement, treatment, education, prevention, and local communities. We promote college coalitions to develop environmental strategies to lessen underage drinking, and particularly drinking on campus, binge drinking on campus. Another of our strategies in regulatory is to solve our licensing workload problem by streamlining and centralizing at our main office. That allows us to get field staff more time to work on the street gaining licensee compliance. And we also look to decrease the information that we ask from our licensees and our tracking of that same information. And thirdly, our strategy in regulatory is to update our information management through technology. Our business plan for merchandising focuses on increasing the number of liquor stores and improving the location of those liquor stores. Also improving the physical appearance of the stores, improving our customer service and product availability, and efficiency and profitability by technology and inventory control improvements.
Thank you. Senator Winters, and Representative Johnson.
Long-range plan, how many new stores are you planning to add, and within what time frame and in which geographical location?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, our plan has actually called for getting up to 250 liquor stores by the end of the 2003-2005 biennium. I truly do not believe that we're going to make that figure. That's very aggressive. It would be 12 new stores, And in this biennium, we added six stores. So I would suspect that we'll probably do six. And as far as, I'm sorry, the second part of your question?
Well, the geographical location that you plan.
Mr. Chair, so
and if it's following population trends.
Thank you. Thank you for repeating that, too. We have not chosen the geographical areas for those stores. However, it will follow population trends. We have in our report, in our plan, we actually have a way of doing that. We take a look at the numbers of growth in population in the counties, and then that determines what counties the new stores will be in.
Thank you. Representative Johnson and Representative Patridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought I understood your testimony earlier to say that the commission is contemplating suspending the addition of new stores. I must have misunderstood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I'm not sure we'll suspend, but I think we will certainly slow down the opening of new stores without more staff.
Patridge?
I think 4 years ago when I was hearing your budget, you guys were doing an experimental program with, you were doing something I think at Salishan where you were able to do a liquor piece there. Are you guys doing those types of things still or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, that was only open for about a month. There were some problems with the lease there. I think that things like that are certainly on the block. We don't have anything out there right now similar to that. But as we move into this next biennium with looking at various new ways of doing business, I'm sure that that and a number of other clever options will certainly be in front of the commission.
Okay.
The purpose of these plans, we really needed to maintain our service levels in the face of having fewer staff due to our ballot measure 5 reductions. In 1993, we had a staff of 242.42 FTE. And today we have the same mission. We have more population, more licensees, and our governor's budget has 201.52 FTE. We have more demand on our services due to the growing population, which has grown 24% since 1990. And we've had tourism growth, which has created greater demand on restaurants and entertainment facilities and in getting licenses. And we've also had some lifestyle and cultural changes. The Restaurant Association reports that Americans eat their meals out 40% of the time. There's more demand for a variety of products, and there's a very high level of juvenile alcohol consumption. So these plans have actually enabled the commission to maintain service levels while gaining efficiencies and controlling our costs.
Excuse me, Representative Patridge.
I also had a question on regarding your licensing, and we've had growth, but also we had a very significant change in the licensing law during this last biennium. Is that in terms of where you're all at, did that increase the amount of licensing pretty dramatically?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Patrick, I believe that you're speaking to the fact that all of our licenses got condensed. We went from 37 to 12.
Well, a lot of people who could have never been licensed before also to receive licenses.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Patrick, actually, we've tightened up our criteria on issuing licenses. So
tell you that this there are people who are able to obtain licenses who otherwise weren't able to obtain licenses under the other law. So my only question was,
hold on.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, Representative Patridge. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We did have a quota on licenses. That changed a couple of biennia ago. The legislature took away the quota, and so there is an unlimited number of licenses now.
No.
So that may be.
No, but we changed the licensing law to, we made the licensing law so that people could apply for more. It wasn't so difficult to try and jump over a bunch of barriers if somebody wanted to get licensed.
Licenses.
And you combined your licenses and
we
had
did.
A broader. We can go on.
Sorry.
No problem.
Okay. We had a number of efficiencies and ways to control our costs, and I'd like to start showing you that in the regulatory program. During the 90s, our liquor license applications and licensed businesses increased at an unrelenting pace. To simplify the process, this shows the growth of the liquor licenses and the staff numbers that went down in the mid-90s, and then the staff numbers going down again in 2003-2005. To simplify the process, we needed to streamline efforts, and we had some things to help us that were initiated by the legislature as well as OLCC staff. And as Representative Patridge noted, we consolidated many of our license types and eliminated some of them. We went from 37 licenses down to 12. We simplified our renewal process by changing the local government endorsement process. We simplified our rules, guiding how staff determined whether licensees met statutory requirements for providing food service in conjunction with serving distilled spirits. We streamlined our internal decision-making process and delegated more. We reduced some report writing and minimized our fact-checking and information verification. We simplified our forms not only for users but also for our staff. And we sought more efficiencies through computerizing and centralizing file access. We focused the regulatory program on liquor law compliance and enforcement activities. Historically, the Commission's regulatory activities ranged between either education on the one hand or enforcement activities and compliance on the other hand. We went from one extreme to the other. Today, the Commission is seeking a balance between those two things. Education is important, but it's inadequate by itself without that stronger liquor law enforcement component. Our enforcement activities alienate licensees unless efforts are made to help them understand the laws. So it's essential that we continually strive toward improving the knowledge of our constituents, and we create educational programs focused on specific licensee areas, such as training brochure for package store clerks. And we also get involved in programs seeking to reduce alcohol use by minors. And simultaneously, it's important that the Commission have a wide array of enforcement options, such as the Minor Decoy Program, to ensure that licensees understand that they're going to face the consequences of violating law. While we continue to believe the most licensees want to follow the law, enforcement activities can serve as a useful deterrent. We also reach out to other interested parties. We provide written information, such as the police officer's guide to our police officers that we work with, and the guide to local governments, to all the local governments and cities that we work with. And we also meet with groups and organizations to further information exchanges, education, and understanding. In addition to our outreach and educational efforts, publicity about regulatory activities helps to further the agency's mission. Research shows that publicity about licensees who pass or fail minor decoys has a deterrent effect. Licensees seem to improve their performance when the public knows the result of these operations. To affect behavioral changes in large numbers of individuals requires changes in society's views and values, particularly in terms of underage drinking. You have major societal shifts that take 10 to 15 years to accomplish. For instance, MAD began in the early 1980s to change people's attitudes toward drinking and driving. It took over a decade for society to change its attitudes about what was acceptable and what wasn't. It also took decades for society to change their view on smoking. Until fairly recently, it was considered acceptable to smoke in the presence of non-smokers. Underage... Thank you.
She's going to have a smoke.
Thank you.
I thought you were asking for your purse. Boy, not in here, please.
Sorry about that. Underage drinking is still a major concern for the state. 80% of our youth have consumed alcohol by the end of their high school. One half of all 10th graders have been drunk at least once. And 37% of our 18 to 25-year-olds have participated in binge drinking, and that's consuming over 5 drinks in one sitting. And this is not just a problem for Oregon. This is a problem nationwide. In 1998, the cost nationwide of underage drinking was almost $53 billion. And this takes into account violent crime, traffic accidents, suicide, as well as drownings and treatment and so on. But $53 billion nationwide. Our minor decoy program is showing results, I'm happy to say, as is, according to the Century Council statistics, Oregon's alcohol-related traffic fatalities decreased 37.7% from 91 to 2001, and our youth under 21 alcohol-related traffic fatality rate has also decreased 43.2% from 91 to 2001. These are improvements, to be sure, but we have a long way to go to curb this problem.
Jim Patridge?
Did you say earlier you had a pop in your budget on, I was trying to look at your pops for college-age drinking enforcement. Are you going to speak specifically to that later on, or is this the part where I should ask that question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, you can ask it now or later.
Well, if you have the statistics later, then I'll wait. But
okay, we have the statistics later. I don't have them right now.
Okay. Well, that I'm just I just preface that I'm interested in knowing some of the statistics. Before I'll support that pop on the fact that, you know, I think we've driven a lot of college drinking underground since universities have been under a lot of pressure to change their alcohol policies. And frankly, I think there's been a lot more binge drinking and more incidents of alcohol problems. And so I'm concerned that we, by providing more enforcement, we continue to drive it underground and encourage binge drinking as opposed to not really teaching people how to handle alcohol responsibly. I was a resident director for a fraternity during the time when Willamette University across the street changed its alcohol policy pretty dramatically, and it used to be in a more open drinking, which is what we try and do responsibly as adults to some degree. There was some binge drinking, but not a lot of it. And now, while I was a resident director there, they changed it radically, and it drove it underground and caused a lot more binge drinking. So I'm interested to see statistically incidences of underage drinking, and alcohol-related problems on college campuses versus changes in their alcohol policies to see.
You do have some graphs on that, Karen?
Mr. Chair, we don't, but we'll go out looking for them and see what we can come up with.
I'd like to know from the university system if we're going to support a policy option to act like that. Because I know the alcohol policies have changed radically with college campuses across the state. But I know that there's some federal obligations to do those as well.
Thank you. I'll move on to the merchandising program now as far as our efficiencies and containing costs.
Karen, I'm going to bother you with just one question here.
That's fine.
You went through the report, the 2002 report, September 2002, pretty quickly, and the performance measures there. I don't know that we'll have an opportunity to come back to those performance measures, but that minor decoy program, am I reading that correctly? And you'd mentioned in your presentation relative to the administration program that Meyer Decoy, number 3 on page 8 on your performance measures there, first attempt, fiscal year 01 and fiscal year 02, 34% down to 27%, is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And then second attempt, why is that going from 10% to 19%? Your comment was it's become much more effective than I.
Mr. Chair, typically that's true, and I'm going to take a guess, and then I'm going to probably ask Linda if I'm right. But, okay. Go ahead.
Sorry. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Alex Lennox, research analyst. The reason that we had a climb or increase is that we've changed our policy, and we've also changed that performance measure. At the time that we had that 19% second sales rate, we were doing almost no second stings. The vast majority of our decoy attempts were first attempts, and the number of second decoy attempts had plummeted to a handful compared to the year before and the year before that. So we've changed that performance measure because as it was written, it really didn't tell us anything because our policies have changed so much. So now we're looking at a performance measure that has a overall compliance rate of 70% or better instead of this difference between first sting and second sting. Sorry, I shouldn't use sting. But compliance attempt between the first attempt and the second attempt. Because, again, we changed our policy and we were no longer doing second attempts. We weren't doing two
that's
attempts.
That's a follow-up at the same location, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We had a policy originally where we only did compliance checks at premises that had known problems. And one of the difficulties that we ran into is that a lot of premises were never checked. Over time, we transitioned into a random program where we would visit premises randomly without regard to whether they had a known compliance history.
So it really isn't a second attempt in the same location from the 10% up to the 19%.
In this one, it is that is. But, Mr. Chair, but in this case, the number of second attempts in fiscal year 2002, I can't tell you exactly, but it's about 95% of the purchase attempts in 2002 were first attempts, and only 5% were second attempts, because at that time we were transitioning from the two-attempt system to now doing a random compliance checks throughout the state without doing one attempt and then two attempts.
Still stand by the statement that's made that the Meyer-Decoy program on reattempts, or on particularly on locations that have had a problem, on follow-up attempts to purchase, they are doing better now than they were previously.
Mr. Chair, that generally is the case, and it's not just here, but it's nationally. The more frequently that you purchase attempts or compliance checks, either at the same premise or at the same city, same county, the more frequent the purchase attempts, the lower the sale rate over time.
Well, perhaps that second attempt for fiscal 2001-2002 is probably skewed then and probably shouldn't have been used.
And Mr. Chair, you're right. That's why we've changed the performance measure. Since we're no longer doing it that way, it's become skewed and really has become meaningless over time.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
We'll get back into that minor decline. I'm sure right now we're doing the high level. And so, Karen, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Commission's merchandising program is driven by two goals. The first one is to maintain an efficient retail and wholesale operation that keeps costs down and optimizes revenue return to cities, counties, and the general fund. Secondly, we strive to provide excellent customer service to the people of Oregon and those who visit our state who purchase alcohol products. The statutory purpose of the merchandising program is to make distilled spirits reasonably available, but not to actively promote consumption. The merchandising program is very lean and therefore very profitable. As you'll recall, there are about 48 FTE full-time equivalents that run this entire program. Our profitability runs 38% to 40%. The recent Governor's Task Force on the Alcoholic Beverage Industry, which is in your book, concluded that private industry could not be as profitable running this business, and they recommended keeping the same system with more modernization. You will hear more about this on Wednesday when Mayor Rob Drake comes to speak with you. He was the chairman of the task force group.
And amongst the other 17 states, none of them are considering privatization of their liquor control commissions.
Mr. Chair, actually, there are a couple that are. Maine, at this particular time, is looking at privatizing not just the wholesale retail side, but the whole enforcement and everything else.
And their commission or their similar study, or I guess their commission, must be more effective than ours, much less effective.
Mr. Chair, what I understand is that particular liquor commission, first of all, they have state stores, and they have the costs of those state employees and the state leases.
I see.
But they have also let the system run down a little bit. So they're looking at doing a whole...
In addition to Maine, are there other states, Karen?
Mr. Chair, like us, typically whenever there's a legislative session, you know, the topic of privatization comes up. But at this point, it doesn't look as though any of the other states are looking seriously at privatization.
Thank
you. Thank you. Case sales and dollar sales have increased all the time in the early 90s, from the 90s till now, and our staff levels have decreased. But our efficiency has improved in merchandising. As I mentioned before, we had the retail business plan for the year 2000 and beyond, and that brings the system into the modern age. In that system, we determined that we needed to add stores to meet growing population demands. We needed to update the appearance and cleanliness of our stores, and we also discovered that customers wanted to purchase their alcohol when they did other shopping. They wanted to have alcohol in shopping centers, whether Safeway or Albertsons were, so that they didn't have to go to make other trips just to buy distilled spirits. So in answer to that, we have opened 6 new stores since 1999. The bulk of them have been in the greater Portland area, but we have opened one in Bend.
Chairman.
I'm sorry, Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we have specific criteria under which the commission will approve the opening of a new store, or is it a more subjective decision?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Devlin, what we do is we take a look at the counties in which there is growth, substantial growth, and then we look at the number of liquor stores per capita within that county. For instance, what we discovered was that Washington County was very underfunded as far as liquor stores. So we added 2 liquor stores, is that right? 2 liquor stores in Washington County, relatively one right after the other. In our business plan, we do talk about what that criteria is by county. And then what we do is we take a look at on a map where our liquor stores are and see if there are pockets that need service. And then we go out and take a look physically at the area and take a look at the retail environment. We talk to the cities, and we talk typically to the legislators within those areas. And then we come back to the commissioners and present our findings, and the commissioners either let us go ahead and advertise the new store or ask us to come back with more information.
Mr. Chairman,
follow-up, Senator.
Since 1999, I think you've had a very good effort to improve the appearance of state-operated liquor stores or agent-operated liquor stores. And my understanding is that while that's been an emphasis of the agency, that the improvements to those stores have been largely the responsibilities of the agent. How do you reconcile the issue that you may get into when you have a store that's relatively not, I wouldn't say profitable, but more profitable, and then you open a store in an adjacent area, which you've influenced the agent to improve the quality of their store, then you open a store in an adjacent area, then you decrease their sales substantially?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, we try very hard not to have that occur. And actually, to be real frank, we have one instance of that in a brand new store that we just opened.
And, might be in my district.
It is in your district. and that particular store, quite frankly, if that agent were to take that store and put it onto 43 in an area, you know, where you could see the store, the sales would not be that badly affected. It would be affected. I'm not saying that that would not be the case. But when you try to find that store, even though you know where it is and where you're going, it's hard to find. So there's kind of a give and take there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Agents have been moving their existing stores to better locations to provide better customer service. And actually, we've had 21 stores that have relocated, most of them to much better locations since 1999. And we've also worked with agents to reduce the state's investment in inventory. It's one of the few areas that we have to really control our costs. In the 90s, as I mentioned before, we converted our warehouse to a bailment warehouse so that all the product in our warehouse is owned by the distillers. It is not owned by the state of Oregon until it leaves on trucks to go to the liquor stores.
Can I ask a question?
Senator Winters.
What is the initial investment for the agent to open up a new store?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, that's a very good question. First of all, on a new store, the agent does not have to pay the buyout, the resignation buyout, to the outgoing agent. Most agents have to pay that. And depending on what size store that is, that can be a relatively substantial amount of money. It can be $50,000 or $60,000 in a big store. a new agent going into a store needs to acquire the lease. And if it's in a new shopping center, that can be pretty substantial. They have to acquire the fixtures and equipment for the store, and many of them actually are using used shelving, which cuts the costs, obviously. But they also have to have counters and cash registers and all of that. So I would say going into a new store is probably in the realm of $50,000 on a minimum.
How are new agents selected?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, there's an ad that goes out into the papers saying that we're looking to open a new store. And it goes into the Oregonian, and it goes into the area in which the store is located. Anyone who is interested can send in a packet, and that packet is gone through by a number of folks who give ratings to the packet based on criteria. And the top-rated applicants come in and have an interview with staff members as well as a liquor agent. And then the highest rating folks from that interview group go to the commissioners, and they make a presentation, and they tell the commissioners what they're going to do with the store and what improvements they're going to make in the case of an existing store or how they're going to build this new store. And the commissioners make the final determination of who the liquor agent will be.
Of the six stores, if I could just ask a question, of the six stores that were opened in this last biennium, how many qualified applicants were there on each of the stores? Were they a lot of qualified? I'm not looking at just folks that would send in a packet to be considered, but of the qualified, those that were could be winnowed out, were there a substantial number on each of the six stores?
Mr. Chairman, actually, for the brand-new stores, we don't get a tremendous number of qualified people. We typically get two or three. We will get more of a group of qualified people for our existing stores that are changing. And I think part of that is opening a new store is really hard. You know, if you're going into an existing store, it's a lot easier to upgrade what already exists than to start from ground zero.
So of the six stores, qualified applicants, there would be as many as three or four and as few as one or two?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Sound very competitive, doesn't it, at that particular point?
Well, again, you need, those folks are the ones who have been in the retail business in one form or another, and they know what they're getting into. That typically is the person you're going to target when you're looking at opening a new store.
Those six stores appear to be doing well at this point?
They're doing very well.
Okay, fine. Senator, I interrupted your line of
questions.
You were on the new stores, and I was still...
And you were still back at the old stores. That's okay. I mean, you know, that's the way it happens.
Yeah,
some of us are more chronologically advantaged than others.
Well, some of us are really, really old. We don't remember our questions too long, Senator.
What is the... I'm looking at it from the investment side. And how long will it take the investment for the person to realize a profit? 2 years, 3 years, 4 years? What's the...
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, it really depends on the size of the store.
Okay.
We have been very conservative in putting the figures out that we believe liquor agents will take home as their compensation for these stores, and all of the stores have exceeded what our conservative figures have shown when they went into the system.
What's the conservative figure?
It varies from store to store.
Can you give me a range from a low of 2%, 3%, but what's the...
Perhaps Alex could bring us that information.
Could you bring that to us? Because I think, you know, in our industry, we pretty much, restaurant industry, you... Going in, you know that you're going to have a X percentage of failure rate, and you know how long it's going to take before you actually realize any profit. So,
Senator Devlin,
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Since this is supposed to be an overview and I'm such a novice at OLCC, do we require stores to stay open a certain number of hours each week?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, they're supposed to stay open 48 hours a week. And basically it's eight hours, 6 days a week, and they need to be open six of those 8 hours between the hours of 12 and 6.
Do we Mr. Chairman, just to follow up, it would be just normal, I guess, from Senator Winter's background that somebody involved in retail sales on a restaurant basis, that their profit line could be adjusted based on how many hours that they were actually manning the store themselves versus having employees. What's our normal? I mean, is there a normal for a store? I mean, how many employees do stores usually have? Obviously, you know, people have vacations. They have...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Devlin, it's all over the board. You know, your larger stores, your Class 6 stores, which are our very largest stores, they will have a number of employees. And if the agent actually works the store, they may not have as many employees as an agent who doesn't work the store. And when you get into the smaller stores, anything that's... basically, you're what we call Class 1, 2, or 3. Those are the lower volume stores. If the agent works those stores, they can probably do it by themselves many of the hours. But that's long hours for one person, too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that in looking at hours, what if I can follow up on Senator Devlin, is that in the restaurant industry, you may have where you're open for noon, but you've got a lull period to where there is no traffic, and I think he was looking at traffic issues. And, you know, it'll vary from restaurant to restaurant. I would assume that you'd have that same kind of variance in the retail sale liquor business where your volume is probably greater on a Saturday and where you probably need everybody. You need to be fully staffed, whether if you open at 12 or if you open at 10. Where it would be different if it was on a Monday, for example, and that so those kinds of trend lines. But if you have, everybody has to open the same time, you may be having to have staff there that you wouldn't have to have if you had the flexibility of adjusting your hours based on your traffic flow. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know some fast food franchises require that the owner actually be in the store during some period of the operating hours. Do you have that same requirement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, up until April we do. And the reason I say that is that we have a new contract that the commissioners will do a final approval on in April. And in that new contract, we do not have a stipulation that the liquor agent needs to devote any particular number of hours to the operation of the store itself. What they do have to do is be responsible for whatever goes on within the store. Currently, a liquor agent is supposed to devote at least 40 hours a week to the operation of the liquor store.
Thank you.
And I just coming back to page 20, the employees dropping from over 240 down to something less than 220 appears to be about a 10% reduction in total employees of the OLCC. Is that in 1993-94, is that around the time that you enhanced your information technology? What surrounded that reduction in overall staffing?
Mr. Chairman, that reduction had to do with ballot measure 5, and our information technology really began, our development of that really began more in 1997. So we had that drop, but we didn't have at that point the efficiencies gained until later.
So in 1997, with the enhancement of technology, then we don't have any reduction until now in 2002-2003.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Of reduction in employees. And business licenses, during that time, that's when we had the 30-day, and now we're up to the 45 to 60 days of the licensure. You anticipate, according to the 2003-2004 numbers that are blipped out there, an increase in the number of licensed businesses. Will that come to fruition with the extended period to 120 days?
Was that taken into account?
Is it still on the steep line that may be graduating off a little bit?
Mr. Chairman, the request for licensed businesses will certainly continue along that steep incline. Our timing as far as getting those licenses may cause it to back off a little bit.
Okay. I have a bill somewhere out there for license. I understand that it provides for everything, including renewals, but new licenses. I better work with Mr. Steubenvall on that to make sure that we get that heard so that you would have the revenue resources available to do this if we're going to be cutting back on employees. So I'll need to follow up and find out where that's at and start getting hearings on it because that looks like it could be pretty important in order to maintain the market penetration statewide.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Winters.
Mr. Chair, along the licensing issue, what kind of impact implication would the reduction of staff have on event licensing? Because that hasn't, I don't know if that's been discussed while I was out of the room.
No. Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, we actually have simplified that process somewhat. So a lot of the event licensing has been really narrowed down with our redo of the licensing criteria, so we'll still be able to handle it. Again, people coming in, though, and needing their license that same day may not be able to get it. It will take longer to make these things occur.
Well, I appreciate that you have, you know, simplified that process because usually event individuals don't have a very long window to get their licensing served.
Were those license issued strictly here in Milwaukee, the event license?
They're in all of our field offices, okay. Milwaukee as well.
Okay.
I'll continue talking about our inventory and the merchandising program.
Okay.
We've established individual store goals for our liquor agents to assure optimal levels of inventory in the stores. And inventory as of June 30th, 1999, was $23.5 million at retail in the stores. And in 2002, as of June 30th, we're down to $21.1 million in the stores. And that's even though in that same time period, we opened 4 new stores. So our agents are doing incredibly well in meeting these goals. But we need technology in order to track inventory if we want to gain even further efficiencies in our stores.
You hear that inventory per store in the terms of number of days sales per store?
Pardon me, Mr. Chair, do we have it?
You have that in relationship to the number of days sales per store. That would be, I think, more meaningful. Than the average amount of gross cost of inventory in a store. I assume you're reporting a cost, inventory cost.
Mr. Chairman, these are retail figures here, actually.
Oh, okay.
But we can get those figures for you.
All right.
The distribution center continues to handle more cases of liquor without more staff. As you can see by these charts, our staff has remained pretty stagnant, and yet our cases that the staff handled has gone up since 1995. And the bottom chart shows that the number of cases per FTE in the warehouse in 1995, each person handled about 83,000 cases in a year, and now that figure is up to over 100,000 cases in a year for every FTE. We did that through technology and other efficiency improvements. We replaced our conveyor system over a 3-biennial period. We also have a warehouse management system software piece that we just installed, and we have radio frequency scanning devices that read barcodes in our warehouse. We also expanded our recycling efforts to reduce our waste disposal costs. We limited our will call and repack orders. Will call is when a liquor agent calls the day before they want to come pick up five or six cases at the at our warehouse. And we had folks who managed their inventory and would come 30 times a month. That really is very costly to us, so we still make it available, but we limited the time, the number of times people could do that. We did the same thing on repack. That's not repack is when you have a split case, basically, if you want three bottles out of the case as opposed to the full case. So we still give both of those services, but we just limited the use of them.
Senator Winters?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have the figures of what would be the waste or the lossage figure for your inventory operation, both from the overall distribution as well as from your agents? How much is really going out the back door?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, out of the warehouse, it's almost nothing, and out of the stores, it's 0.01%. Our shortage figures in the stores is very, very small.
Could you give us what the almost nothing is?
I can.
Thank you.
We'll bring that back to you.
At the breakage, while it's on consignment, is that picked up by the consignors, or is that picked up by us as a consignee?
Mr. Chair, if we break it, we own it.
Okay.
We also work with our suppliers to improve processes to reduce our staff time in reviewing product requirements and managing our inventories, our industry's short-term price reductions. Another thing that we have just recently done is come out with a new price book. This has all of our products in it. It also has articles on various topics, whether it be brandy or gin, and also has recipes. We used to put out this price book. We paid for this price book, and we also sent it out. This price book, we do not pay for the production of. It's paid for by advertising from the distillers. We do still send it out.
Senator Devlin?
Mr. Chairman, this sounds like an odd request, but could the committee get copies of the price book? Knowing that Mr. Lang in the audience knows that I don't drink any alcoholic beverages at all, but I would like to get it for purposes of comparison between states.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I'd be happy to supply you with this one. All the others, unfortunately, have been sent out to the liquor stores, but I'll be happy to give you the one I have.
Thank you.
Karen, I think Senator Devlin is really anxious to get the recipes.
We'll be happy to help.
Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little mystified. That magazine is done for the benefit of the agents.
It's actually, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, it's actually done for the benefit of the licensees. That's how we started this. However, when we discovered that we could, first of all, save some money by having an advertising company do it and make it so that it was more of a consumer magazine, it now is a benefit to liquor agents, too, because they can have it out on their counter, their customers can pick it up, they can read about the products, and they can also get some recipes and so on. So it's really, it's made a much larger impact than the price book had before.
Senator Winters, recognize?
Well,
I'm sorry, wait a minute, that may not have been responsive.
We're still confused, so who all gets it?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, the liquor agents get it, and they give it to their licensees and their over-the-counter customers and whoever else. Those are basically the audiences.
And so you do a run of 100,000 of them?
5,000.
5,000, okay.
And you're sold out, huh?
Senator Johnson.
Well, then, and this magazine that you have given us today, who receives it?
This is an industry magazine, Mr. Chair, Senator Winters. This is an industry magazine, and it typically is, it goes to the control states. That's predominantly the folks who are interested in the magazine. And on the cover, this is all of our liquor commissioners, and inside are articles about the Liquor Control Commission.
I recognize the bodies. Who pays for it?
We have not paid anything.
Trade magazine.
Correct.
Absolute Vodka paid for this.
I guess what I'm trying to get at.
And just as an aside on this, Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, this is a picture of Senator Devlin's newest store in his district in the Statewide magazine article.
I just wonder about these table decorations you've got here in the office.
Mr. Chair, that's not my office.
Oh. Thank you very much.
I'll move on to the support services program.
Please. We'll finish up with the support services and then come back tomorrow, get Satish's update, and we'll start in there. That's a good place to pick up, I think. Go ahead.
Thank you. We've relied on information technology to gain efficiencies and will need to do so more in the future. I mentioned to you earlier that we installed a warehouse management system that's automated our distribution center. We've also instituted what we call an OLAS system. That's an OLCC Liquor Agent Services System. And basically what this system does, it allows our liquor agents, who particularly the rural liquor stores, who use these Scantron sheets to do their orders and mail them in. It allows them to do the order on a computer and use the internet to send the order in or the inventory. Our Ontario liquor agent has been using this system and is quite pleased with it. It saves us mailing costs, and it saves the agent having to send it in a week before they ever need to get the order into the warehouse.
Sounds like a promotion of Ontario's liquor store, and I want you to know that I've never been inside of it.
That's what I probably figured.
That's just what I was thinking.
I am pleased to know that he's using Scantron, but it makes little difference as long as he's happy and efficient. I think that's fine. However, one of my constituents is here. Let me introduce Dan Joyce, Commissioner Dan Joyce in the back, from Malheur County, and he could tell me probably whether or not it is efficient.
Does he drink your share, Mr. Chair?
Dan is straight from Ireland. His family is all from Ireland, so he's come over to celebrate with me, and we've got some root beer up in their fridge.
Just a bit of Milani.
Yeah. Please.
Well, in addition to that system, we also have a wireless LAN system. LAN is local area network, and we have that throughout our building so that our staff can move with their laptops and be on the go and stay tuned in to the net wherever they are within the agency. And we also replaced our obsolete liquor auditor hardware and software so that they're more efficient out there in the stores when they do audits. They get in and they get out so the agents can get back to doing their business. We continue to work on projects such as centralizing our regulatory information as well as transmitting more data from our liquor stores. And, of course, we need more automation if we're going to achieve inventory effectiveness, or at least more of it. The State Controller's Division has recognized our Fiscal Services Division for excellence in financial reporting, and we have received the Gold Star Award for our seventh consecutive year. And we've also realized a reduction in energy usage by implementing the division policies from DAS and installing energy-efficient equipment and fixtures whenever possible. The mandate was that there should be 10% energy reduction, and I'm pleased to report that our natural gas consumption is down 39% and our electrical consumption is down 18%. We've also engaged our staff in finding ways to save time and money. We've expanded our recycling programs to include composting on our 14-acre facility in Milwaukee, and we received the Governor's Sustainability Award this last year. We've also purchased a cardboard baler for the millions of cases that we have in our warehouse, and we also have a shrink wrap compactor. All of our cases come in with lots of shrink wrap over them, and this shrink wrap compactor compacts it right down. So it's clear that our...
Representative Patrick?
I just wondered if you had any increase in energy costs. Everyone on this committee heard from the economists come in, and I know you guys are running efficiently, but is there any... They were expecting 6% increases in energy. I know that yours is super energy intensive, but do you assume anything?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, our energy costs have gone up substantially, and any of the savings that we've had have simply enabled us to stay within our budget on energy costs.
But in the 03-05 budget, have you assumed, what kind of assumptions have you assumed? Or is it just the standard?
Energy costs? Well, will stay within budget, but I'm not sure whether
the angst is with the increasing prices of energy, including transportation energy, that was of concern, and what projection had been used in the 0305 budget layouts, and that's been an issue that we're concerned about. Something we flew through at about 200 miles an hour in the 0103 budget, and then immediately went into the energy crisis. So,
uh-huh. And Representative Butler, we're aware of that, and that our consumption rates came down, but again, we didn't save any money because it cost us that higher amount. But I will look into that.
Are you confident in your projections? I guess the question is, and to get back with us, are you confident in your projections?
And I've heard from our budget director, we'll take a look at it and make sure.
They can lower the temperature in the warehouse. We're not concerned about the inventory freezing. So.
We will bring that back. We'll take a look and bring it back. It's clear our strategic planning and planning efforts have been very successful. Our workloads in regulatory and merchandising have increased substantially during the 90s, and our mission has not changed at all. Our staff declined, and yet we're providing better customer service and controlling our costs better today, due to streamlining, to delegation, to technological changes, and to well-thought-out planning. We're proud of what we've accomplished, and we intend to continue the focus in the future. You've already taken a look at the Stateways magazine. You can imagine that we're pretty proud of this, and if you get a chance to read the articles, it really is a very nice article on Oregon.
Great quotes from the chair. Appreciate that.
The OLCC focuses on sound business principles to get our work accomplished in all three of our programs. And we also work proactively with our liquor agents, who are the front line in providing distilled spirits to those who responsibly consume them. Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to answer any questions. That's really all I have for you today. If you would like Merle Lindsay to give you an overview on revenue, we could do that as part of this overview.
Why don't we come back and start with Merle tomorrow, if we could do that, and let's move that for tomorrow. And we'll also hear Satish and then relative to the governor's balanced budget as well. So let's go ahead and adjourn until even time tomorrow.
Mr. Chair, I just have one question before you
get
to the
gavel.
If I called your office, would I get a answering machine, or will I get a live voice?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, if you call my office, you will get a live voice.
Okay. And any comments made today about anyone's use of alcoholic beverages? Seriously, in jest.
How's that?
With that, stand to be.
Thank you.